tears of joy after a deal that was years in the making. American journalists and top dissidents are freed in a historic prisoner swap.
I don't buy this idea that you're gonna let these people rot in jail because other people may be captured.
And why the massive seven-country deal at this moment in time? Also, why experts say wrongful imprisonment is a key component of the dictator's playbook to silence all opposition.
These are people who are dedicated to truth, to shining a light in those corners where autocrats are just hoping that their darkness can continue.
Today is Saturday, August 3rd. Join us as we explore the issues in the news. Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington.
It didn't feel real until we were flying over England. I'm a British citizen, Irish citizen, Canadian, and American. So as we came over England and I looked down, that's when it became real. We flew over Ireland, then Canada, and into America, and then I knew I was home.
Former U.S. Marine Paul Whelan, one of the three Americans released from Russian custody, who finally stepped foot on American soil late Thursday. And waiting for them, President Joe Biden and their loved ones. VOA's Jessica Jarrett reports.
A moment long awaited for. Three Americans released Thursday from Russian detention, arriving at Joint Base Andrews just outside Washington. On the tarmac to greet them, U.S. President Joe Biden, Vice President Kamala Harris, and their families. An historic deal involving several allies secured the release of 16 political prisoners held in Russia. Their price? 8 individuals requested by the Kremlin. Photos documented the journey home. Wall Street Journal correspondent Evan Gershkovich and Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty editor Alsu Kermasheva with former U.S. Marine Paul Whelan, pictured on a plane and speaking with Biden on the phone. Gershkovich's newsroom erupted in cheers earlier in the day at news of their colleagues' safe return. The Moscow correspondent had spent close to 500 days in a Russian prison.
You don't realize quite how emotional it all is until you have this release, you know, both his release, but also just this physical release almost to see him free. And people realize, you know, wow, you've actually been feeling quite worked up and pent up and upset over what's been going on.
Similar scenes greeted Kermasheva's newsroom at RFERL in Prague. Her husband, who works at the network, spoke of the family's months-long ordeal.
Right now, we're overwhelmed with emotions. We're still trying to process what actually happened to us today. Being in the White House, hearing Alsu's voice from the Oval Office next to President Biden, that was something very special. But it's been an incredibly difficult year for us.
From their reunion under the media gaze, the families travel on to a facility in Texas to receive support and privacy while they adjust to their return. For Liam Scott at Joint Base Andrews, Jessica Jarrett, VOA News.
Earlier Thursday, as the release was confirmed, a White House video showed tears of joy in the Oval Office the moment the families of the freed Americans first spoke by phone to their loved ones. A key to the Kremlin agreeing to the deal was the release of Vadim Krasikov, a Russian serving life in prison in Germany, following his 2019 conviction for the murder of a Chechen dissident in Berlin.
Toughest call on this one for other countries. I asked them to do some things that were against their immediate self-interest. And really very difficult for them to do, particularly Germany and Slovenia. Slovenia came in at the last minute, and I tell you what, the chancellor was incredible.
VOA senior national correspondent Steve Herman joins us now on this elaborate and complex historic deal.
This has been in the works a long time, many, many months, and it was a complicated diplomacy because this was not only something directly between Washington and Moscow. It involved a number of other countries, Russia, Germany, Turkey, Slovenia, Poland, Norway, Belarus. And this is definitely historical, and it's the largest prisoner exchange since we've seen in decades since the height of the Cold War.
Why now? What can you tell us about the timing of this?
Well, I can tell you from decades of experience of watching these sort of things come together is they come together when they come together. There's always an impetus, and obviously there are high-ranking officials. We assume Vladimir Putin in Moscow and Joe Biden in the White House, of course, who really want it to have this accomplished. We can see from the position of the United States why they wanted to free these Americans, because it's been a major issue and a lot of pressure on the administration, a lot of pressure coming from major news organizations such as the Wall Street Journal and Radio Free Europe, the sister broadcaster of the Voice of America. What are the motivations here for Russia to do this? We don't know initially. Obviously, the Russians are not a government. The Kremlin doesn't usually just do things out of the goodness of their heart. Obviously, they're getting back several of their high-value people that were detained in other countries. And this includes, apparently some people that Germany and other countries were reluctant to release.
Is it surprising to you that this happened so close to the presidential election and not after the results in November?
You know, if you want to get cynical, it's possible that once the Russians realized that Biden wasn't going to be president regardless after the election in November, that, it took some of the, it changed the equation. But what we're hearing is actually just an hour before President Biden made his Sunday afternoon announcement that he was not going to continue to run for re-election, he was on the phone with the Slovenian prime minister helping to get this deal finalized. So it doesn't appear that there was any direct connection in that regard.
But it certainly is significant.
Well, it's certainly significant in that President Biden and by association, Vice President Kamala Harris, as part of the administration, will be seen as accomplishing something that is really, really significant. And it's something that happened on the Democrats' watch. And any good news for them getting within 100 days of the election is certain to make Americans in general just feel better about the administration, perhaps.
VOA Chief National Correspondent Steve Herman, thank you so much.
You are welcome, Lori.
Among those still being held in Russia, Mark Fogel, an American school teacher. As President Biden was departing the White House Friday, reporters asked him about Fogel, who was not part of the deal.
We're not giving up on that. You want me to tell you ahead of time so he doesn't get out?
Biden said U.S. officials still hope to secure his release. Fogel, who had also worked at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow, was sentenced to 14 years in prison for drug smuggling after being detained at a Moscow airport in August 2021 with 17 grams of marijuana in his luggage, which he said he uses for medical reasons. And for more analysis now, we're joined by Freedom House Interim President Nicole Bibin-Sadaka. Thank you so much for being with us. Let's just start with your reaction on this historic moment.
We were deeply relieved to hear the news that there would be a large number of political prisoners and foreign hostages that were being held by the Russian and Belarusian authorities, that they would be released. We are really grateful to the governments that worked very hard to secure their release. And we recognize that this just shows the difference between what democracies and autocracies are doing these days. Countries that have governments like they have in Russia and Belarus have been holding innocent people, many of whom are journalists, human rights activists, have been holding them as prisoners with no crimes committed. And they've been holding them for years in many cases, whereas the democracies that we saw over the last number of months and years to secure the release are committed to ensuring that innocent people can be reunited with their families and be returned to freedom.
This was months and months of negotiations at the highest levels of governments. It was about 2 years in the making, and one of the sticking points was Russia's demand for the release of a hitman, an assassin, Vadim Krasikov. This man was being held in Germany, and Germany didn't want to release him. What does it could say about the importance of relationship building and alliances?
I do think the important takeaway is that democracies saw that their citizens or others that even weren't their citizens were being held unjustly because they were journalists, because they were human rights activists, because they were doing the things which all of us do every day, which is critique our government, ask for a different government, ask for our voices to be respected and to be heard, to actually have free and fair elections. Those are things which we do every day in a democracy. And here you have democratic governments coming together to say, we will not stand for people who are exercising their universal rights to be thrown in prison, mistreated for years and years and years, and they fought to get them out. And I think that's the good news story of the day. I think it's also very important to remember how many people are being held still in Russia, in Belarus, in many, many, many countries around the world where governments are trying to silence democracy and human rights activists, journalists, women's rights activists, because they are demanding their rights. And the way that these autocratic governments respond is by throwing them in jail.
Do you think that deals like this give countries that want to silence people more leverage to potentially hold them as bargaining chips? Is it just not possible to do these kinds of deals without some sort of swap? Obviously, they felt like the safety and well-being of these people were worth it. But does it encourage countries to do more of that?
Yeah, I'll leave it to others to analyze, you know, the parity of the swap. But I think the most important thing that we're focused on right now is just welcoming these individuals home and using it also as a moment to spotlight what Russia and other autocratic regimes have been doing for years and years to repress their own people, to repress other human rights activists, to repress foreigners who are there visiting the way many of us do to many countries. And I think that's the most important story today is what can we all be doing at this point to try and push for the release of the hundreds of thousands of people who are languishing in prisons around the world for simply exercising their universal rights that all of us who live in democracies are able to do every day.
And of course, press freedom is key to any democracy. This was quite distressing to see two American journalists imprisoned in Russia. President Biden is encouraging people not to go to these places, but that also doesn't allow for information to necessarily get out.
A very big story of the day is really is press freedom. You had also Kor Masheva, who was a Russian-American journalist. She's been detained since October 2023. You had the Wall Street Journal journalist, Evan Gershkovich, also detained since 2023. Vladimir Karamurza is a Russian-British citizen, but he's an American green card holder. Right. He is a journalist with the Washington Post, and he's been detained for over 2 years. And he himself had survived two poisoning attempts by the Kremlin before that. And so there's no doubt that the Kremlin is fearful of these people who have chosen as their profession to report fairly and freely and accurately about what they are seeing in different countries. And the response that an autocratic regime does is to silence them through imprisonment.
Interesting story. Apparently, they, as in people being held in Russia, had to fill out a form in Evan Gershkovich. In the form, there was a paragraph that you could make a statement or make any comments. And apparently he as a journalist, wrote asking if Vladimir Putin would give him an interview.
Oh, a true journalist, deep in every moment of his day. Absolutely. I think journalists are so extraordinarily important to democracy and to giving voice to people in autocracies. And I think what you see here, you know, through the story you just explained about Evan, but also the really courageous writing of Vladimir Karamurza while he was in prison, just to write these extraordinarily eloquent op-eds about his time, about what it says about the Putin regime. These are people who are dedicated to truth, to shining a light in those corners where autocrats are just hoping that their darkness can continue. And, you know, I salute the courage that they showed during their detention, prior to their detention. And I am hopeful that they will be back at their trade and craft of reporting on what is going on in Russia and Belarus and in so many other places where people are not yet living free.
And just circling back to what you said about so many people being held still in Russia and in other places around the world. world. Do you see efforts being made to find ways to also get these people released? It seems like a very daunting task.
It is. There are many organizations. I'll just speak about a bit about Freedom House. We work around the clock to have political prisoners, many of whom their names are not as familiar as Evan's or Vladimir's, to have them released. And we work with partner organizations, we work with governments, we work with any number of other partners, democracies around the world, to really push for these individuals to be freed. They're in jail for their religious freedom, exercising religious freedom as journalists, as women's rights activists, for people who simply blogged or tweeted about things in their country. There's a lot of efforts being put forward. The reality is the United States is a nation that stands for its citizens and has a significant amount of weight. But in many countries, it's their own government that is imprisoning them. Many of the people who are released today were actually Russian citizens. Mm. And it's a challenge when you do not have a democratic government that will go to bat for you, because you are then at the whim of a government which truly does not represent you. And I think that's the challenge and one of the key things to take away from this day and these moments, which is there is such a stark difference between living in a democracy where your government will go to bat for you, where your government does have free and open media, which will shine a light when the government doesn't do what is in the interest of the people. Very, very different than those who live under autocratic regimes, where the regime is about its own self-preservation, not about serving the people.
Freedom House Interim President Nicole Bibbins-Sadaka, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Lori London. Well, as we've been hearing, a big part of the story of wrongful imprisonments is that they're a big part of the autocrat playbook. For a deeper dive into how autocratic leaders rise to power and what keeps them there, VOA's Steve Miller speaks with Anne Applebaum, author of Autocracy, Inc., The Dictators Who Want to Run the World.
What do you mean by autocrat, autocracy? And since it's kind of a broad label, how does it differentiate between other labels like communists, dictators, theocrats, nationalists?
Autocracy is a political system where there is one leader or clique or party that controls and has absolute power. So it is not, there are no checks and balances. There are no obstacles to power. The judiciary is controlled by the autocrats. The press is controlled by the autocrats. The economy is controlled by the autocrats. And autocracies seek to maintain their power through repressing opposition. And they can have different ideologies. They can be left-wing. They can be right-wing. They can be theocracies, like Iran is a theocracy. But their central characteristic is not what they claim to be or what they want to be. It's that they rule unchecked.
When I hear that kind of terminology, I think about constitutions and codes of conduct. You know, in the West, we think about rules-based order, and we look at international organizations like the United Nations that have charters where there's universal declarations of human rights and guidelines for countries' behaviors. Many of the autocracies across the world are signatories to these documents and parts of these organizations. So how did they emerge if they're also part of these organizations where conduct is supposed to be regulated?
So autocracies don't have rule of law. Rule of law means that everybody in the state, at least in theory, is subject to the Constitution, to the rules, to the legal system as it has been defined by some kind of legitimate body, a parliament or a Congress or a constitutional convention. In autocracies, they have rule by law, and that means that the law is whatever the autocratic leader says that it is, and they don't have to obey any kind of neutral bodies, whether it's domestic or whether it's international. And increasingly, you see autocracies around the world, and here I'm thinking of Russia, China, Iran, North Korea, and others, who don't even pay lip service anymore to international law and to the treaties that they've signed. They don't even pretend to acknowledge them. In the past, often they did. They would claim they were meeting the criteria of the treaty, and this is rarer and rarer. So you see, for example, with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, that was an example of a country saying, "I don't care about the UN Charter, which talks about the sovereignty of nations, you know, and I don't care about the norms that have been set up in Europe since the Second World War that say we resolve disputes by diplomacy and we don't change borders by force. I don't care. I'm going to defy them, and I don't care who says what about it." In addition to that, you've seen the Russians carry out real atrocities on occupied territory. They set up concentration camps. They've arbitrarily murdered and tortured people. They have kidnapped children. They've taken them out of Ukraine and moved them into Russia, changed their names. All of those things are indirect defiance of treaties the Russians have signed and international norms that many assumed were respected by most nations. And as I said, increasingly the autocratic world, and particularly this network of autocrats who I describe in my book, just don't care anymore.
So how did these individuals and countries get to where we are in 2024? Because if we dial back the hands of time, coalitions of governments fighting against fascism, fighting a coalition to displace dictators who carry out attacks on other countries. So how did we get to where we are?
One of the ways we got to where we are is that there was a shift about a decade ago when the leaders of particularly the two most important autocracies, Russia and China, made a decision to treat Western constitutional democracies and the ideas of Western democracy. So, you know, freedom, rights, the rule of law as threats. And this is literally in a document that was put out by the Chinese Communist Party. You can hear it in speeches made by Vladimir Putin. They identified those ideas as threats to them and to their power. And they began to very slowly act together, both to help one another, but also to help other weaker autocracies stay in power. So any dictator anywhere in the world who's in trouble has been able in the last few years increasingly to count on support from the others. A great example is Venezuela, a country that's in crisis as you and I are speaking. It's a very, very weak dictatorship, very catastrophic, incompetent. In Venezuela is a country that's been destroyed. Its economy is in ruins. Millions of Venezuelans have gone abroad. They've left the country. And yet for a decade, the Russians, the Chinese, the Iranians, and others have invested in Venezuela. They helped Venezuela get around sanctions. They loaned money to Venezuelan companies, but also supported particular people in Venezuela. The Iranians had deals with Venezuela. Venezuelans offered the Iranians visas, for example, for Hezbollah activists. That's one of their proxy groups. So they see each other, they prop up one another, and they've helped one another stay in power. Even weak dictators who should have fallen, who aren't popular and who aren't successful.
So what's the ultimate goal of autocratic governments and China, Russia, as you put it, to help weaker ones that may or may not have been able to stand on their own? Is it just to ensure local governance, as you put it, to rule by law without checks and balances?
Part of it is money. These autocracies are run by very, very wealthy people. They're often billionaires in their own right, or else their families are, or there's a small group of businessmen around them whom they have enriched and who are dependent upon them. And they make money in one another's countries. They invest across borders. So part of their motivation is financial. And part of their motivation is, they see this as a war of ideas, that they want the ideas of autocracy to rule and to win in what they see is a contest against a different set of ideas. As I said, the rule of law, transparency, accountability, freedoms, freedom of speech, freedom to associate, even freedom for ordinary citizens to have some influence and play some role in politics. And they are in a war against those ideas because those ideas threaten them. That's the language that's used by their own opposition, the activists in their own countries who have agitated for them to change.
There's two things in your statements I want to follow up on. The first thing being money. Where do you see the intersection of autocracy and kleptocracy?
I mean, they're very often the same thing. Kleptocracy often precedes autocracy. And so, for example, when very, very wealthy people become wealthy through stealing from the state or by enriching themselves through state contracts or through their connections to people in power, increasingly they see it as in their interest to maintain that power and to push back against anybody who wants to regulate them or who wants some, more fairness or more justice. And so you see that the very, very wealthy, who's particularly in states where, as I said, the wealth is state dependent, they participate in an autocracy, they join with it. And very often they're the same thing. You know, certainly in Russia, you know, you could call Russia a kleptocracy. You could call it an autocracy. Essentially, it means the same thing. Kleptocracy just means a state based on theft. And that's what Russia is.
That was Anne Applebaum, author of Autocracy, Inc., The Dictators Who Want to Run the World, speaking with my colleague, Steve Miller. And that's all the time we have this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, thank you so much for listening. For more news throughout the week, listen to International Edition Monday through Friday, or visit us anytime at voanews.com. Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.